My name is Ward Minnis, and you're listening to the Seven Skeletons podcast. Seven Skeletons is a limited series art experience that tells my story and the story of my family, the family of Bahamian artists that includes my father, Eddie Minnis, through the lens of our lifelong relationship with the Jehovah's Witness religion. For a transcript of this podcast with supporting images, please visit the mentalslavery.com website. You can find the link in the show notes. There you can leave a comment or feedback on this episode or on the project as a whole. You can also see the original painting that is paired with this episode. So without further ado, buckle up and sit tight. I'm bringing seven skeletons out of the family closet. This episode is Skeleton 4. It's titled House Arrest and Daydreams. Tragedy is the difference between what is and what could have been. Abba Ibn. God had to be first. No compromise. Family had to be second. This is how my father describes his life's priorities in the Ting and Ting documentary. Now, this is not an unusual stand in a religious society like the Bahamas. But what does it mean to be a Jehovah's Witness with no compromises? When the main thing in your life is devotion to a cult, what follows from that? This is not the position of every Jehovah's Witness, mind you. There are witnesses who maintain relationships with disfellowship children and grandchildren. There are those who just live their lives, knock on some doors every other week, and do just enough to maintain their standing. But these aren't the role models. They aren't the people who are celebrated at witness conventions. Witnesses can't force all their members to have the same level of fanaticism. Those that don't display the right amount of zeal forfeit any hope of advancement. For example, you can't be an elder if your house isn't kept in order. Until I took a tangent, to borrow his phrase, my father's house was very much in order. 1. To understand the Minnis family is to know that because they want to be good Jehovah's Witnesses, they have placed themselves under house arrest. It's hard enough to be a regular cult member, but to be a good one requires so much more. This means that many of the decisions in their lives are made for them. From the very basic and trivial, like how they spend their time, to larger concerns like whether or not to go to university, to have children, or whether or not they can have a blood transfusion. You can see the impact of this core decision expressed over and over again in almost every aspect of their lives. Take higher education, for example. When I finished high school in Eleuthera, I didn't even bother to apply to a college. I wanted to put Jehovah first, just like everyone else before me had done, and therefore, didn't see the point. I was going to be a pioneer minister. I didn't even know how I was going to make a living. Paint, I guess. The Watchtower does not flat out say, "Thou must not go to university." What it does instead is call it a personal decision, then not so gently tell you what to do anyway. Witness literature portrays colleges and universities as the home of satanic philosophy. Since the end of all things is so near, their argument goes, do you want to spend the short time left getting a degree in Satan's home, or earn God's favor by knocking on doors? The decision is left up to the individual, but if they want to be a good witness, the choice is clear. If a witness does decide to go, as I later did, they are judged for that choice and are labeled as not being spiritual enough. While I was a member, I couldn't shake the guilt I felt for going to COB. Of course, my later turn away from the religion was chalked up as proof that Watchtower was right all along. My sisters had the same mindset when they graduated high school. They both excelled academically, especially Shan, who got a remarkable 8 A's in her GCE O-levels. Despite the obvious talent, they did not pursue any form of higher education. If memory serves, Shan actually applied and got accepted to numerous universities, only to turn them all down. The end of the world was apparently so near when they finished high school in the late 80s that there was no time to get degrees. They were applauded at the Kingdom Hall for making the best choice by giving Jehovah their youth. Fast forward to now, nearly 40 years later. The imminent nearness of Armageddon was still being used to scare others into the same dead-end choices until very recently. On August 22nd, the witnesses suddenly reversed their decades-long stance on additional education and have now made it okay for their members to pursue if they so choose. In making this radical U-turn, they didn't apologize for their failed predictions or for the consequences their policies have had on millions of people. They won't be made accountable for all the potential they have wasted. In the end, it's people like Nicole and Shan who are left holding the bag. 2. Witness teachings like the Paradise Earth are deeply embedded in the family's art. Paradise is the hope that the majority of members believe in and cling to, that after Armageddon, they will get to live forever on Earth without sickness and death. For example, when my father began his art practice, his landscape paintings would capture the complete view of a scene, almost like a historian. However, over time, as Amanda Colson observes, he began to deliberately excise objects of human intervention, cars, telephone poles, even the people themselves. This practice of removing traces of modern life from his paintings actually mirrors witness images of paradise that also don't include modern objects. Images in the watchtower that do include things like telephone poles and streetlights are horrific scenes from their imagined Armageddon. Objects of human intervention are therefore used as a kind of visual shorthand to show an image's place in the witness's end-of-the-world timeline. Apparently, there will be no streetlights in paradise. That my father, a longtime witness, also began to remove these types of objects from his work isn't surprising. He's giving you a preview of what God will supposedly soon do himself. I believe this practice is more a sign of conformity to witness teachings than probably even conscious choice. Because of this, I would argue that my father's art has become not a plea to revere the earth and live in harmony with it, as Colson says, but rather a fantasy of what paradise will look like when we, the heathens, are all gone. The parallels between my sister's art and witness imagery found in the watchtower is also striking. Their art has numerous examples of laborers either engaged in farming, yard maintenance, or household chores, but, as with the watchtower examples, always without any modern tools. They also incorporate witness compositions of the endless delights of paradise in their work. Or, on the other hand, they also portray people looking longingly towards paradise from the despair of this current reality. With very few exceptions, it is possible to insert any of my family's paintings directly into a witness publication without modification, as if the family has been working on a Bahamian edition of the Watchtower magazine, consciously or not, for their entire careers. I don't think these connections are coincidence because these are the images that my family has been consuming for decades and that my sisters and I were literally raised on. Interestingly enough, Nicole has actually worked for years in the Watchtower Art Department in New York and has likely produced a few anonymous masterpieces for them. Anonymous because all the work published by the Watchtower goes unattributed to enhance the illusion that it comes from divine sources. 3. The family has come under criticism in recent years as their work has grown increasingly out of step with contemporary Bahamian art practice. In the director's cut, my father addresses this criticism by saying that some people call what we do chocolate box cover art. According to Colson, some also describe their work as mere decoration. Is Minnis family art like this, though, because of the demands of the marketplace? Or because their religion doesn't allow them to be anything else. As the example of my life shows, Jehovah's Witnesses discourage freedom of thought, and anything a witness does or creates that could be seen as being worldly or against Watchtower doctrine could lead to punishment. While there's definite market pressure to produce work that is safe for the majority of buyers, I believe fear of going against witness rules also plays a large part in defining their art's content. This dual pressure leaves little room for experimentation, play, or growth. Many of the very things that we expect out of artists, but are, for the most part, absent in their work. The impact of this religious pressure from the witnesses and how this affects their art is probably best seen in the example of my father's potluck cartoons. For 10 years, from 1971, he was the leading commentator on Bahamian politics with his immensely popular editorial cartoons. Even though this was something he had started before he converted, his practice gradually came into conflict with evolving witness teachings on the matter. Witnesses discouraged members from expressing or even having an opinion on politics, and this stand became more hardline in the late 1970s. I've heard a few stories about this, but they are all some version of him having to make a choice between his faith and potluck. In the end, he chose to be a good witness and abruptly ended his influential creation. Witness rules on politics also extended to his music, and he soon ended his satirical work there too. While his albums were never fully political, songs like People to People, a sharp skewering of the Ministry of Tourism's 1975 program of the same name, and Show and Tell, a blow-by-blow account of shenanigans surrounding the 1976 Public Disclosure Act, were political and satirical standouts, not to mention big hits. This type of material vanished from his music around the same time that he canceled Potluck. In retrospect, it appears that his cartooning helped fuel many of the sharp insights, both political and social, that he then brought to his music. Once Potluck ended in 1981, the music was left anchorless and began to drift in a more judgmental and preachy direction. A good example of the difference between his Potluck-era work and his more recent output is the lone new song that he recorded for his first Greatest Hits album, released in 1996, entitled Reap What You Sow. On an album filled with political and satirical classics like Nassau People, Show and Tell, and People to People, this new song featured lines like, "Listen to what the Bible say. It say, if you plant it, it will grow, and you will reap what you sow. If you don't want to ruin your life, remember sex was made for husband and wife." It wasn't a hit. On a certain level, of course, the song was also social commentary. But most, if not all, of the humor, compassion, and most importantly, relevance, were gone. 4. There's a clip in Ting and Ting where I claim that my father could have done more, after which I receive an immediate narrative rebuke, as the film cuts to Fred Stirrup saying that to think about Eddie giving more would be selfish. Am I being selfish, though? I understand that I have a perspective on this topic that's not widely shared, but my point of view is deeply grounded in my own experience. I know that being a good witness put a cap on the art that I was able to produce. Simply put, what I created as I was leaving the religion wouldn't have been possible if I had remained. By leaving the witnesses, I was able to explore my feelings without fear of offending an elder or going against their theology. For example, when I sent a draft of my play The Cabinet for my mother to read, I had forgotten that witnesses don't believe in an immortal soul and see any depiction of a ghost as something satanic. She was so offended by the ghost that was a central character in the play that I don't even know if she finished reading it. In this light, my father's career can best be understood if we divided it in two. He began as a Bahamian trailblazer. His early years were full of national firsts like his cartooning, bold strokes like his painting on the side of the road, and showed clear ambition. It seemed that he was always looking to do something new and fresh, and from everything I have heard, he was a carefree and fun-loving person. This joy of life could be seen in his early work and in the energy he put into the Bahamian art scene. The second phase of his career came after he joined the Witnesses and became more and more religious, perhaps fully manifesting in 1981 with the cancellation of Potluck. Following the witness mandate to be no part of this world, there was a narrowing of his social focus and a closing of his worldview. All his energy was then put into his evangelizing, and in the little time that he had left, he stuck to the well-worn paths he had already cleared. His palette knife technique got tighter, the music became less relevant, and Potluck disappeared. As for my sisters, they've been locked into their styles and subject matter since the beginning of their careers, and their art has always been more about making a living than self-expression. So what I'm thinking about when I say that my father and by extension my sisters could do more is an admittedly imaginary world where they are free from their witness lockdown. If they were just freed from the enormous time commitments of the witness lifestyle, they could create more art, quantity. But I believe that if they also dropped the witness outlook on the world, their art would be of a far different quality. You can call me selfish for having this dream, but this is the Minas art I wish I could see. 5. It's impossible to calculate the total price my family has paid to be good Jehovah's Witnesses. I know the cost to me and my life has been astronomically high. It's an interesting yet frustrating thought experiment to imagine what we as a family could have been had we not been witnesses, or at least not taken it so seriously. Despite their choices, my father is still recognized as a Bahamian icon and legend, and my sisters have cemented their place in the local arts, such as the power of their talent. Perhaps, in the end, to a young nation in need of artists and heroes, it doesn't matter. We have what we have, and we should be grateful. On the other hand, I am always left with the sorrow of what could have been, and what we will never get to witness. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Seven Skeletons podcast. In the next episode, I'm going to share something that I've uncovered. It's not about politics or power, but it's about art, silence, and how you get erased from the family story. That episode is titled Bahamian Conspiracy Theory. If you are enjoying this podcast or finding it helpful, please take a moment to subscribe, leave a like, or even write a review on it. This can go a long way to helping other people find the program and would be greatly appreciated. Please visit the mentalslavery.com website for bonus posts and original artwork related to this program. I'm Ward Minas, and we'll talk more soon. Parasite.